wants to warm up. Let's warm up.
Good evening. This is Liberty Southwest podcast number 44. Tonight we have Chelsea Camo, Lydia Tabbitt, and myself, Eric Taylor. This is episode number 44. We're recording the evening of Wednesday, February the 11th. Chelsea, why don't you kick us off on the topic, which is going to be education this evening.
All right. Yeah. So tonight we wanted to talk about education. And, you know, there are a lot of things going on in the field of education right now, but we kind of wanted to back it up and kind of talk about education in general in terms of, you know, techniques employed privately versus publicly, and where we see maybe education going in the future. There has been a concern that I've had personally about what types of information we're feeding to children when we send them off to public schools, for example, and whether we see any agendas being pushed into the education that our children are providing by textbook publishers, for example, and whether our children are getting unbiased information and if they're being provided with an education that allows them to think for themselves. So, what do you guys think?
Well, I think that runs in varying degrees. So you have, if you're talking about education in general or, you know, starting off, you know, in, preschool, kindergarten, you have a variety of options. So you can go private, public, charter, and you kind of, you know, you get different type of education, you know, whatever institution you choose. So I think really what you're talking about when, you know, it's questionable on the content of, you know, various curriculums, you're really talking about public schools, right? Because if you go, I mean, if you have the financial resources and the desire, you can really, for the most part, I mean, there are some qualifications, some guidelines, but you can place your child in, you know, whatever institution suits your comfort best, right?
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, if you're, you know, a family that has enough flexibility financially to be able to stay at home and homeschool your children or to be able to afford a private school, well, then you can kind of pick and choose and say and hold them accountable. Because if you're paying the bill, you can say, you know, I don't like, you know, that you're teaching my children X, Y, and Z. And, you know, you have the flexibility to choose to place them in a different school if you don't like what they're teaching. Yeah. But for the majority of Americans, they don't have the resources to be able to pick and choose, you know, where to send their children. And so the reason that this is a really big deal for me is that, you know, when you take children who are 6, 7, 8, you know, even 12, 13, 14 years old, they don't have the brain development to be able to identify when a person in a position of authority is giving them bad information. And they can't really speak up and say, hey, I don't like that you're telling me this and I don't want to write that down on the exam. And I think it's a lot more difficult for them to ascertain what's fact versus what is agenda. And they're vulnerable. I think that we need to be cognizant of what's being taught in the schools and be careful about what we're allowing people to teach our children.
And, you know, if we're going to talk about public education, you know, in the context of elementary, middle school, high school, the way that, you know, public education has been conducted is, you know, changed quite a bit even over the last 35, 40 years. Because really a good chunk of the curriculum, and, you know, standards and teacher evaluation kind of emanates from, the Department of Education, which isn't that old. The Department of Education is, 35 years old, federal agency, with a, you know, annual budget, of $70 billion. And, that's grown, actually grown, substantially even over the last 5 years, from $32 billion in 2009 to $70 billion in, 2013. And I think that's a bone of contention, with a lot of people who are concerned, with how, education is conducted, and they're concerned that it's not a reflection of the local community. It's more of a top-down, driven type of initiative. And I think, and I can't speak for HLC, but I think that's probably a good chunk of what you're talking about, right?
Yeah. And then, I mean, and as we speak about how much money we spend on it, you know, we're consistently seeing American students underachieving when compared to other countries' education systems. So if we're spending all this money, what is it that we're achieving? Because we know that we're not achieving the best math students. We know we're not achieving the best English students, even though it's our first language. So what is it that we're achieving? That really begs the question, I think. I spent several years during college formally tutoring people, and, you know, many years before that just helping out my friends. And I have seen students who have who are going to college, who are adults, who have a high school diploma, who are incapable of understanding what a fraction is and what that represents, or who are incapable of composing full, complete sentences in their native language. So it really makes me wonder, what is it that we're teaching people, if not those basic things? What is it that we're teaching them? And does it signify, you know, that there's really something wrong with the way in which we're teaching people? I mean, we talked briefly before the show about the concept of how our system resembles, it's the banking system, or do you know, Lydia, what's the official name of that theory? It's like the banking model.
Yeah,
like the banking model. And so basically the ideology behind our current education model is that, you know, there's a teacher up front with all the knowledge, and then there are these students, and these students are empty receptacles with which we are to deposit information into. And so it's this very passive relationship as far as the student goes. You know, so the teacher stands up front and just shoves information into these empty receptacles. And the more and more research that's being done about education, we start to realize that more effective methods of education revolve around curiosity and involvement. And if we just, you know, cram facts down students' throat and ask them to regurgitate them, that really isn't education at all. You know, we've taught them how to memorize something and repeat it back to us. And that doesn't really develop critical thinking skills or the types of skills people are going to need in order to survive in the real world. You know, so do we want people who can regurgitate some piece of data so that they can go out and be really successful at, you know, a trivia game at the bar? Or do we want people who have knowledge and curiosity and know how to learn and grow and participate and understand things on a deeper level?
And I think what you're, the exact term you're looking for is banking education. So you're pretty close. And I think that's some of the criticism, even behind, educational initiatives like Common Core, is that, the focus is more on standardized testing rather than critical thinking. And that's kind of a devil's advocate perspective. But in the modern classroom environment, I think there is reason to be concerned where the educational curriculums are not necessarily tailored for the individual student, but tailored for, you know, classrooms in general. Um, and And there's, you know, we talked about this a bit before the show, but there are more and more options available to students that allow you to tailor education through blended learning, where, you know, not only will you take, you know, where students actively participate in a classroom environment, they can augment that with online learning. So that can be through collaboration with teachers, students, through forums and message boards and that type of thing, which is, I think, is being utilized more and more and will continue to be utilized and should have some pretty good outcomes in the years to come, I think.
And I'm sure this comment is going to alienate a fair amount of people, but I'm going to throw it out there anyway. If we can think of an illustration of the impact of curiosity and interest on someone who's trying to learn something, let's think about this for a minute. You know, the education system has been, you know, deeply crying about ADHD and ADD in the classroom and how that's interfering, you know, with the teacher's ability to teach and the rest of the students' abilities to learn. And they say that there's something maybe, you know, that there are extra challenges associated with these children trying to learn. Well, in all of these cases, whether someone's been labeled ADHD or ADD, they have interests in which they're extremely capable of learning. So some of these students, for example, might have interests with video games. Now, they're capable of learning that to an nth degree. I mean, they're capable of excelling, but it's something that they're interested in and something that they're curious about. So I think in just, you know, as a surface example, you know, we can take these children where teachers might say, oh, well, they need, you know, some sort of special education, or they can't be in a normal classroom because they have, you know, a learning disability. Well, no, maybe they don't have a learning disability. Maybe it's the way that we're trying to shove information at them that is ineffective. It's not that the children, you know, have problems. It's that the education model doesn't work.
Right. And I think for, you know, a lot of the students that you're referencing, you know, who are into, I mean, there is, to a certain extent, gamification of education that's taking place, and a lot of these students who are, you know, immersed in gaming and various technologies are, you know, as they kind of progress through school, I think the challenge is for teachers to provide them with instruction that ties into their interests, because there are a lot of, especially, you know, going forward, the economy is being, in the workplace is being increasingly driven, by computers and technology, and there are going to be more and more jobs available. In fact, there's a skill deficit in most technology related fields. And, you know, these students who may, be deemed as problem children within the classroom. I think, you know, specifically when you talk about that type of individual who can pick up information that they're really interested in quickly and utilize it, you know, to their benefit, that those are tangible skills that should be identified by teachers and nurtured, rather than, you know, suggesting that they think about, you know, some type of prescription or regimen to get rid of that. And I think that's, hopefully that's a challenge that's going to be addressed in the classroom going forward too.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think that, well, and I think another part of, you know, and this goes back to the model of education. So another part of the issue is we look at these children and say, well, gosh, here's a 7-year-old who can't sit in a chair for 8 hours a day. What's wrong with them? It's like, last time I checked, 8-year-olds have a lot of energy. They're not built to sit in chairs and listen to somebody talk at them for 8 hours a day. People aren't built that way, you know. And so just because a child might be antsy because they're being asked to do something that's very unnatural, I don't think that necessarily signifies that there's something wrong with them. And I think that we need to start looking at it and saying, we're asking children to sit in chairs for 8 hours a day. Is that really healthy for them? Is that, you know, how we should be going about this? Or do we really need to look at our approach?
Well, there needs to be, you know, to, you know, every person, every, you know, child or adult, they need to move. I mean, that's, you know, over evolution, that's just a part of, you know, what being a person is. You need to move around in order to be healthy, physically or psychologically. And, you know, that's something, I think ultimately that's something that, should fall on parents. They should make sure children participate in either extracurricular or, you know, organized activities or get enough exercise. And if children do, that really takes that takes care of a lot of the hyperactive, you know, type of issues in the classroom. And it has, I think there is also, to a certain extent, physical activity as well as diet are, you know, at play. There's, you know, some of the dietary patterns of kids leaves a lot to be desired. So it's kind of and unfortunately this is a socioeconomic problem, I think. As you go down the socioeconomic ladder, both educationally and from an income perspective, it's worse. Dietary and behavioral problem gets worse as the lower you get, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it is unfortunate. You do hear about a lot of children where, you know, their school lunch might be the only meal they're getting in a day. Yeah. You know, and it's an extremely unfortunate situation. But I don't want to get too far carried away into, you know, nutritional, you know, aspects of this or the socioeconomic considerations to be had. But
it's a pretty real factor, you know, when you're talking about outcomes. I mean, obviously, there are outliers in any situation, but, you know, as a general rule, you can find pretty strong correlations when you're talking about physical health and mental and psychological fitness. So, I mean, they go hand in hand quite a bit, I think, and you know, especially when you're talking about a classroom environment.
Right. Well, and I don't know if you guys have seen, there have been a bunch of studies that have come out lately about how sitting and lack of movement is just as, you know, risky or even more risky
than cancer
health-wise. Yeah. I mean, sitting is what's killing us more than smoking, more than, you know, obesity, just the lack of movement and the fact that we sit at desks, you know, in our offices and our cubicles. And then, you know, we get into our car, sit down, drive home, get home, sit on the couch. The sitting is killing us more than anything else. It's crazy. Have you guys seen that?
Yeah. In my workplace, we're just, you know, it's office environment, but, going through a redesign where everyone has standing desks if you want it. So.
Oh, that's nice.
So you can, it's essentially, I mean, you hit a button. It's a traditional desk. You hit a button, it goes to a standing desk because there's I think more and more, you know, both in the educational, you know, in all realms, sitting is recognized as, you know, ergonomically and, you know, physically it's not good for you. A lot of people, I've used standing desks before and that's something I don't know if you guys, have you ever heard of a standing desk in a classroom environment?
Never. Yeah. I mean, it doesn't mean it's not out there. I just haven't heard of it, you know.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it seems to be something that would be a no-brainer. I mean, one thing I don't understand is why they're so expensive, though. I mean, they are fairly expensive, aren't they?
Yeah. I mean, you can actually find a decent standing desk for under $600. I think the conception is there, when you're saying expensive, you're thinking over 1,000.
Oh, I'm just thinking as compared to a traditional desk,
oh,
that they're more expensive than the typical, you know, sitting down desk.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it just doesn't conceptually make any sense to me. Why would, you know, just the fact that it's a little bit taller, why would that make it, you know, more expensive? I don't know. But
yeah.
Maybe because it has to be able to adjust to a person's specific height. I don't know. That would maybe make more sense. But
Danny, are you on?
Hey, guys, can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Yeah. You're
a little, you've got some echo. You're kind of muffled. I can hear you.
Is it pretty loud? Yeah, this is testing here. So I'm calling from my computer, so it's I can't really test, you know, the sound. I can't really hear myself either. So is it too loud, or is it kind of muffling? Did you say muffling?
What do you think, Lydia?
You sound great, Danny. You sound great.
Okay.
Are you sitting at a standing desk right now, Danny?
Yeah, ergonomically, how are you doing right now, Danny?
I'm trying to sit with my back straight right now, so but I'm sitting, unfortunately. I'm not standing. I can't stand because my table is just this height, so I can't move it up or any down, but it would be nice. So but I'm sitting down. I just want to add in with the standing desks and all that. I don't know why it's I don't really know the prices and all that, but could be that, you know, it's relatively new, because like back when I was working my old job, like, there's some people that have standing desks, and not everyone has it, so it's like a new thing apparently.
Yeah.
And maybe because of that, you know, they're willing, you know, they can, you know, make it expensive. I'm sure it doesn't cost that much to, it doesn't cost like $1,000 or even $600 is ridiculous for a standing desk. But it's probably because it's a new thing. They can charge it because it's, you know, relative new. People are demanding it. Who knows? And maybe that's why it's expensive. I don't know.
But that's kind of, I was just kind of going, that would be, you know, Chelsea, you're kind of talking about how kids like to move around and that type of thing. But it seems to me that might be, you know, a decent concept to try out. And, you know, if you're moving around or, you know, twiddling rather than sitting in a desk all day, you can, you know, have a group of standing desks that could use, and that could help a bit.
But then here's my question. So even if you have a standing desk in the classroom, let's say your classroom has like 30 people, and, you know, I'm like the dude at, you know, fifth row and sixth column, whatever. Mm-hmm. Like, hey, you know what? I don't want to sit. I'm going to, you know, move my stand or whatever. I don't know how the classroom standing desks work, but I'm assuming that you can just adjust the height or something like that. Is that how it works?
I don't think any of us have ever seen one in a classroom.
Does it even exist?
I don't know.
I can't say that it doesn't, but no. Lydia?
I wanna say I've seen a standing desk in a classroom setting, but I can't. I'm not 100% on that. I'm sure they exist, though. I can't think of a specific circumstance, but I'm sure I've run into a standing desk in some sort of classroom setting.
Yeah, I'm looking at an article off a website called District Administration. It has a picture of some students in standing desks. It says, a new twist on concentration. Standing while you work, as a group of students, you know, standing desks rather than desks where you sit down.
I guess I feel like maybe we're getting a little bit in the weeds here with the standing desk thing.
All right.
but my opinion on the standing desks is sort of just like my opinion on education is just like my opinion on healthcare is my opinion on social issues is that, and I probably will say this until I'm blue in the face, but I just think there's so many things just generally in life that are not one size fits all. I'm such a huge believer in the individual, and I think there's very few situations or policies that are improved by making things one size fits all across the board, same for everyone. And I think education is just as much one of those things as healthcare, as just as much as, like, you know, there's not one specific type of social structure when we talk, like, social issues, like, you know, gay marriage or whatnot. I think that just generally choice and individual preferences are complex and diverse, and I think in education that's just as important as in any other, field of everyday life.
I think that's a great point that you bring up. And there's actually, so our modern education system kind of came out of the era, the industrial era, when, you know, the whole factory model, you know, where you can, you know, put students on a belt and push them through the factory line and they come out a finished, you know, well, you know, rounded adult. And we're coming to realize that people are not like, you know, you can't just put them on a conveyor belt and have them turn out the other end. You know, it has to be customized. You know, people learn in different ways. Some people are visual learners. Some people are auditory learners. Everybody's unique, right? So the idea that we can stick everybody in the same box and have them come out the other end, you know, all perfect, it doesn't work. And, you know, so the current model that we're using is antiquated. And it came out of an era that has now passed, you know. And so I think the challenge here is how do we customize education in an economic way, you know, without it being extremely cost inefficient? How do we provide customized learning experiences that are tailored to how a person learns?
Well, I was referencing, and I haven't played a clip in a few shows, I was referencing The School Revolution by Ron Paul, and he covered some of these challenges. And I have a clip, it's about 3.5 minutes long, that probably can push us. I mean, there are a lot of ways that can be broached, or a lot of the strategies can be used. So I'm going to go ahead and roll this clip, and we can discuss it more after.
The name of the book is The School Revolution. And how are we going to, first give me the premise, and then how we get there.
Well, we have a broken system.
Yeah.
And we have to offer them something else. Now, homeschooling's been around for a while. In the 80s, we had to fight real hard to make sure they didn't close down all homeschooling, and that fight was here, occurred in Texas. But most people now, and it's not just conservative, there's people mm-hmm. from the other side of the spectrum who realize that the system isn't working. Every single day you see the violence in school and kids getting out of school and they go to college and they have to be taught how to write again and mm-hmm. spell again. They have to learn their English.
So like
the system
is
very much broken. And I go over that on the history. But also, I want to have a curriculum that talks about the freedom philosophy and people thinking along these terms and have a different perspective on history, which you're very interested in, mm-hmm. different perspective in history and economics, mm-hmm. obviously, but also to change the atmosphere with the idea of getting young people prepared to either go to college or start their own business. And the easiest job is convincing people there's something seriously wrong with the system.
That's easy.
But unfortunately, you know, in Washington, you know, economics, things go bad, spend more money, print more money. And that's the way it is in education, too. They want to just spend more money on it.
The problem is, though, and I know this as a homeschooling dad, my wife feels the same way, it's terrifying because this whole society has taught you don't have a certificate. You're not smart enough. You can't do that. You don't let professionals. If I hear that one more time, let the professionals do it. Give me a break, man. Look what you've churned out. The system is churning out a bunch of people that cannot survive.
And homeschooling isn't like If I were required to homeschool, I happen not to have homeschooled, but let's say I was to homeschool in this day and age, and I've been through the sciences and medicine, but if I had to sit down and explain physics at this moment, you know, I'd have to work at it. It isn't like the parent has to know every single
right.
thing. I mean, in the instance that we have in the curriculum, we want people to be helped on the internet. That's what's so great about
That's
the
right.
internet. And there'll be lectures on the internet, and there'll be communication among the students.
Oh, can we pause for a
internet.
Second?
There'll be
just a second.
Pace with parental.
Okay.
So I don't know if you guys are aware of this, but there's this growing trend amongst major universities and different organizations that are putting a lot of their classes and knowledge online for free for people. So, you know, if you are, you know, a parent that's trying to homeschool, like Harvard, MIT, you know, I think UC Berkeley, and then in addition to that, a bunch of nonprofit organizations that are just putting free knowledge and information available to everyone on the internet. There's so many resources out there for people to get free knowledge nowadays that you, like he's referencing in this clip, you don't have to know everything about everything in order to homeschool. Like, there are so many resources out there for you to get supplementary information and to be able to learn and provide insight in a multitude of ways.
Yeah, I have another clip. EdX is the consortium that was started between MIT and Harvard. I have a clip with the provost of the two universities that kind of talk about that. Another good example, I think a lot of people have used it, Khan Academy. They have, you know, really a majority of subjects from K through 12 that can be accessed, and it's become quite popular. So there are video presentations augmented with message boards that you can kind of interact with instructors and students and that type of thing.
There's also
go ahead.
Just want to add in that there's also Coursera. That's another good free service you can use that. That they offer a lot of educational topics, like, you know, if you want to learn about calculus or economics or anything business-wise, even like music, you know, Coursera is another one that you can do, and they give like online certificates when you complete it. Typically, they come from like University of Michigan, you know, Pennsylvania, all those big name universities.
Yeah, that's also another good one. I'll continue. This clip's almost done, so we have about another minute or so.
Well, help. There's more guidance in the first 6 years, you know, because they're not they need more guidance. In, but later on, you've had the experience, and obviously you allowed your kids to make a little bit of decision on their own.
Yeah,
you know,
they go
like
their
this,
own pace.
This instead of everybody does this and march them in and sit down, and some people describe it as prison. I thought, holy man, you know, that's pretty much true. Walk in and sit in this chair and don't move.
Right. And go at everybody else's pace and learn at the average way when we're boxing everybody in.
Yeah, and I think that's, I read an article that Bill Gates wrote on homeschooling as well. It's grown from about 1.5% to 3% of total kids are homeschooled within the last 10 years. And that's kind of the, you know, if you have the resources and the time, that's the area where the most innovation is taking place. As far as blended learning, really focusing on individual teaching habits and that type of thing. I know quite a few homeschooled children or who have been homeschooled as children, and the only thing that I see that I notice, and I don't know if you guys have noticed this as well, is their social skills sometimes are a little bit lacking. That's the only kind of negative that I see with the homeschooling stuff.
Well, I actually knew someone who, and this is an interesting approach. his parents had sent him to public schools from kindergarten through, I want to say, like, fifth grade or sixth grade. And then they homeschooled him from, like, seventh grade through, like, 11th grade. Mm-hmm. And then he got to then finish up his senior year back at, you know, public school. And he was very well-rounded.
He was.
Extremely, you know, intelligent and educated and still had those social skills. And I talked to him about it. And he said, well, it was perfect because he got to build his group of friends, you know, when he was growing up as a kid. And then, you know, by the time he went to homeschool, while he was being homeschooled, he still participated in those extracurriculars and then still maintained his group of friends that he had already developed, you know, throughout that high school and middle school, junior high period. And he said, you know, the most productive years he had ever had in his education were when he was at homeschool. Mm-hmm. But the fact that he could have started out at public school and gotten to socialize and build a good network of friends, he said, I didn't lose out on any of that social aspect even when I was homeschooled, because I maintained those friendships and those connections the whole way through. So that's kind of an interesting, you know, way to go about it.
Yeah, for sure.
And another family I know out of Chaska that homeschools, another way that they kind of do it is they have friends who also homeschool their children. So then, you know, you've got a network of families that are all homeschooling, and then they can pull their children together to provide that social interaction and that network of friends. And they found that to be very successful as well.
Yeah, I know a family that just did just as that too. So just kind of reaching out to other networks of families and, hey, let's homeschool together. Like, okay, so that, yeah, I knew a family like that too. And, you know, the kids were fine and all that. You know, they don't seem socially awkward or anything like that. So. But, you know, I can still see that this could potentially be an issue, especially, you know, when these kids get older and then they head off to college and, you know, they're so used to their little old network of friends and now they're in this, you know, massive university and, you know, trying to get, you know, accustomed with reality. And I can, you know, it's also common that, you know, maybe they just get claustrophobic and things like that and, you know, it just gets weird for some of these kids.
You know, I could see that as something that people would have to overcome, but I believe in human resiliency. And I think that that same challenge is going to be present when you take someone, for example, who grew up in the Iron Range going to public school and, you know, and it's a small setting. Maybe they have a class size of, you know, 30 kids are in their grade or maybe even 100 kids are in their grade. And everybody knows everybody and everybody grew up together. You take that kid and you put them in a college in, you know, L.A., they're going to have that same experience. Like, whoa, this world is much bigger than I knew. And here are all these people I haven't known since I was four. You know, so those challenges are present, you know, with people that, you know, are from rural areas as well, but I don't think that we would say, well, everybody should move to the city. Mm. You know? And I feel that,
yeah.
You know, study after study shows that a person's ability to overcome challenges like that really stem from having, you know, a strong sense of self and also a really strong network of people that care about them. Right. So if you have a really strong relationship, you know, with your parents and your brothers and sisters, or you have some really good friends or mentors that support you, you'll be able to overcome those challenges.
Yeah.
That's true. But I just know a family that, you know, from my church that, you know, they were, their kid was homeschooled and then, you know, once he got to the real world, he just didn't know how to deal with reality. And, you know, all of a sudden, you know, he became more lonely than what it's supposed to be. So, you know, he started doing drugs and, things like that really got, you know, really, tore his family apart, his relationships with his family and friends. Luckily, he's no longer doing drugs and all that. But just seeing that as a reference, you know, that's a potential downside of things. If things don't work out for people who are homeschooled and, you know, get out to the real world and haven't gotten the chance to pick up those skills, things can be tough for them, and they can all of a sudden, you know, do things that's so bad that, you know, even their parents would not have imagined.
Yeah, and that's a parenting and family issue as much as anything else, right? You know, something like that could happen in the context of going to a public school or getting public education or home education. It's all about, like what you reference, it's all about balance, you know, being able to strike that social balance. And, you know, I like the idea, and that's something I was aware of, but didn't think of right away, you know, the socialization idea of either having other homeschool children get together in a somewhat of a informal environment, classroom environment, or participating in, you know, activities, organized activities within the public school system. I think a lot of homeschoolers do that as well. So they're, you know, in the context of education, socialization is just as important as, you know, those soft skills are just as important as hard skills, I think, in most aspects too.
You know, absolutely. And I think that we're seeing that, you know, no method is going to be perfect. I mean, there are plenty of people, you know, I'm sure, just like the family that Danny knows, where a homeschool child grows out into the community, has a tough time coping with it. But then I think there are also plenty of examples that we can all think of people who went to public school who were ridiculed and bullied to the point where, sure, they committed suicide or started to get into drugs. Yeah. So I think that either environment is going to have its own, you know, set of challenges, you know, when it comes to how do children cope, you know, through that difficult time where they're growing up and going through changes and figuring out who they are as a person. And I think, you know, one of the most important things, you know, you can do is just make sure that as a parent or as a friend, that you're providing that support and letting that person know that they're not alone, and, you know, helping to help them get a sense of self-worth so that they can manage another day and make better choices, right, instead of going down those dark roads.
Yeah. So I have a clip on edX, which you're referencing a little bit, and this is kind of future of, and it's a little off what we're talking about, future of online education, and it's a shorter one. I'll roll this and we can stop and start as we see fit here.
These very early stages or something so novel, so new, so different is for many faculty and students at MIT very exciting, at the same time very scary. This is something new, it's different, it's potentially disruptive.
Harvard and MIT recognize the incredible effect that technology is having on education today.
It's opening new vistas in education for the world, for our campuses.
Online education for students around the world will be the next big thing in education. This is the single biggest change in education since the printing press.
Together, Harvard and MIT will be sharing knowledge more broadly.
We plan to make available courses and educational materials to anyone who has an internet connection.
Technology can strengthen education, both for our on-campus students as well as for those around the world.
Our goal is to educate 1 billion people around the world.
online education is not an enemy of residential education, but rather a profoundly liberating and inspiring ally.
So I see technology-enabled education to really democratize learning.
It's really transforming the way that we see material, access material, and interact with the course.
It really tailors the experience personally to whoever's trying to be a part of it, which is huge, I think.
Beginning this fall, an array of courses developed by faculty at both of our institutions will be made available online.
This is not to be construed as MIT Lite or Harvard Lite. The content is the same content.
This will make tremendous resources available to people everywhere. We expect to transform learning in the classroom along with learning online.
edX is, in the very best sense, a work in progress, but it is also an act of progress.
Combining forces from Harvard and MIT, we can do amazing projects that will further enrich how to develop the online learning environment and how to develop the content in the right way for delivery on campus and worldwide.
So that's an overview of edX. It can be found at edX.org, and it's more along the lines of higher education rather than K through 12, which we've been talking about, but I wanted to throw that in there.
I mean, I really like the idea of the open sharing of information and education, and I think that that's great. I just really struggle with how we're going to implement that in a way that is going to be beneficial to the student. I mean, I don't know. I've taken a couple online courses, and I find that it's a little bit more difficult for me to engage in an actual classroom online. How do you guys feel about that?
Yeah, and I've thought about that a little bit. Since you mentioned that, we talked about that. You know, I think one of the things you weren't really thinking about is the fact that it doesn't have to, online learning, it doesn't have to be a individual act. It can be a collaborative effort. So you could have multiple devices, multiple students working on, you know, maybe the same topic, same exercise. And even if you have an online lecture or whatever, you can, students can collaborate together in a classroom or enclosed environment, can throw questions. You know, a lot of the times you have students at varying degrees of accomplishment in any area. So you can have students who are more versed in a topic offering peer feedback or collaboration that a lot of the time doesn't really require maybe direct interaction with a teacher. And that, you know, so there, and I think it's hard, maybe harder for us to conceptualize that since we haven't, you know, our, you know, good portion of our education didn't involve that. So it's kind of, you know, it's a shift in perception as to, you know, as to how you accomplish that. Cause I think when we were talking about, we saw that as kind of a, you know, just a, you know, interaction with a, you know, cold fixed object through a screen rather than having peers to work with that are around you in a classroom where you may be interacting with people and with the screen with different sources of information online and that type of thing. So it becomes there, you know, there are some other, blurbs and clips I have on blended learning where you're not just focusing online. You're using that as a source to augment your in-person learning.
You know, something that I didn't consider earlier when we had kind of talked about the online learning piece that just kind of dawned on me, maybe the reason, so I personally haven't been too fond of the online learning, and like you said, part of that is because I'm so used to the dynamic classroom experience, that that in-person, live, back and forth.
Yeah.
But
typically,
you know,
with
so
the teacher,
it does feel,
right?
You know, kind of cold, you know, when you're doing that online on a computer.
Yeah.
But part of what we're seeing too with like an online course. So like I learn lots of things online on a regular basis. Probably every single day I'm learning something new online. So it's not to say that learning can't happen online. We know that it can. So maybe it's the way that we're measuring outcomes that is kind of flawed. We're using the old method of measuring outcomes. You know, the typical test, you know, is it A, B, C, or D versus creating a measuring tool that can get a sense for whether the student actually has a grasp on the concept.
And that's going to change. I think that's, I mean, it's been around for a while, but, it, you know, the ability to, you know, collaborate holistically with your peers, with teachers is relatively, you know, online is relatively new. And, you know, how you evaluate knowledge gained, you know, how mastery of, you know, subject matter, you know, going that route, I don't think has been, you know, it's not firmly established because we're used to the, you know, traditional test and grade type of methodology, which I'm sure will go through, will be disrupted like a lot of other areas have been disrupted by, you know, by utilizing online resources. So it's, I think it's one of those things that's harder to wrap, you know, our collective minds around because it's still evolving, if that makes sense.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's what we've known our whole lives. And a lot of times it's those things that we take for granted that are more difficult to see beyond. You know, it's like, well, you know, it's a classroom and you have a teacher and they give a lecture and they shove information down your throat. And then afterwards you regurgitate it onto a piece of paper and then they grade it. And we're so used to thinking about education in those terms that it's difficult for us to imagine what might lie beyond with the new resources and opportunities that we have available.
Yeah. And it's interesting to see, and it'll be interesting to see how that impacts specifically public education, because you have charter schools, which have, you know, kind of hybrid of funding between private and public. And they, from what I've read and what I've seen, they seem to be, you know, the good ones. I suppose this applies to public schools, private or whatever. The good ones are doing really well, the really innovative schools, and then you have some laggards. I think the maybe some of the concern is that, you know, maybe outcomes within a lot of public schools won't be as good as you'd like them to be. But I don't know.
So I have a question for you guys. So if you can kind of think back on your life and think about the skills that you've learned and the knowledge that you've obtained, what do you think was the most powerful lessons you've learned and the most powerful tools you've obtained, and how did you go about getting those? I mean, if you think about, you know, whether it was your public education, whether it was personal interest, what were the most powerful intellectual transformations you guys have had, and how did you go about getting those?
For me, I've excelled far more at things I really am interested in. That's always been the case. So, either through, you know, a traditional classroom environment or individually, I've absorbed and, you know, achieved greater results in, you know, subject matter that I really care about.
Yeah, for me, it's kind of like that too, but I think a lot of it has had to do with like the teacher, you know, for me, you know, how motivated the teacher is, you know, teaching the subject and, you know, how much, you know, involvement he or she tries to get involved with the class. I think that was a big part for me. That's kind of one of the reasons, why I chose accounting, because I had a pretty good teacher. You know, I think that had to do with a lot of it, as opposed to, you know, just, you know, sitting in a book and study. Is, you know, it's that motivation factor. I think that's a big piece for me.
So when you say he was a great teacher, What was it about his teaching style that really engaged you?
It's just livelihood, the tone of voice, the classroom involvement, things like that. It's not just like, talking words at this classroom and things like that. It's, trying to get involved with the class and, personality as well. That's key as well. So, I don't know how else to describe it, but just that passion. If you have passion about something and you really show it, people can see it, and that kind of it's kind of funny. I don't know how this dude has passion in accounting, because obviously I don't really have that much passion. But I think that when someone see you're passionate about something, you get that person to be excited too. So that's kind of how it, got me excited in accounting. So kind of regretting it now, but, that's another story.
It's now just a job for you, Danny.
There are good days and bad days.
What about for you, Lydia?
I think Lydia.
Oh, is she still with us?
Lydia had to drop. Yep.
Oh, okay. So what I'm hearing from you guys, is one, subject matter that's interesting. So there's that natural curiosity about a subject that will drive you to be more engaged. And then, someone who can be passionate enough about it that's contagious and that you kind of catch the bug from that. So someone that can engage you, that it's exciting. It's not just shoving information down your throat, but saying, I want you to be involved in this learning and be excited about it. And kind of, that passion maybe drives your curiosity or interest in the subject.
Yeah, and my take on that is those teachers should be as accessible as possible, and they're I don't want to say uncommon, but they're far less common than teachers who don't evoke that type of passion or that type of interest. And I think that's one of the big challenges that the educational system faces is, and I think it will be accomplished to a certain extent through technology is allowing those teachers to be accessed by the most possible students. That to me would provide great strides in education for a lot of people.
Now, do you guys think that maybe what's contributing to a lack of passionate teachers is a constricting environment which they have to survive? So, you have to be part of a union, and you have to, structure your classroom this way, and you can say this and you can't say that. I mean, do you think those types of elements can reduce people's passion, and then we're left with a less passionate, educational, that the teachers are less passionate as a result of how much they're being limited as to what they can say and do?
To a lesser extent. I was one of the things that popped in my mind immediately when you suggested that is that they also don't get paid well. But for most people who do well at whatever they do, finances aren't the primary concern. So I don't know that that higher wages for teachers would bring more passionate people into the realm, because I think those teachers that are absolutely great, they're fine getting paid what they, whatever they get paid. Where they probably should get more, they don't necessarily strive to get more.
Right, they do it because they love it.
Yep.
So.
So that's not an. Now, I guess I'm saying salary isn't an answer for that.
Right.
I don't know if there's a clear answer to that. I think you're gonna, given, our current circumstances is probably about this, as far as quality teachers are concerned, or great teachers, there are about as many now, percentage wise, as though there have been, 20 years ago or 20 years in the future.
So, of course, all of these teachers then were also asking them to participate in a structure or a model, yeah, which we can probably all on this podcast agree is broken.
Yeah.
You know, and you guys shared what was really a key part in your success educationally. As far as, you know, myself personally, I just want to share one example I do have that I think is a great example from public education. I've experienced both public and private. And there was a science teacher I had in eighth grade who gave us bonus points if we could find a mistake in the textbook or if we found a mistake in something that he said. And so it forced, you know, it engaged us because it's like, oh my gosh, if he makes a mistake and I catch it, I get bonus points. You know, and so we're motivated by the points, but what he was really teaching us was to not take for granted that, you know, if it's in a textbook that it's right, or if, you know, a person in a position of authority tells you something, don't just assume that it's right. Don't assume that it's the truth. And it's those critical thinking skills that I think are so often absent from our education that are really some of the most important things that we should be sharing with our, you know, youngsters of today.
Mm-hmm. No, I totally agree with what you're saying. Critical thinking skills is definitely one thing that they, in schools, that they don't really stress enough. And really, critical thinking skills is really, a lot of that is what is needed to, you know, be successful, you know, with what you do in your jobs. Cause, you know, not all problems are straightforward. Like, you know, going to the classroom, read the textbook, listening to a teacher, and then answering questions. And, you know, you get it right, great. You get it wrong, you lose points, whatever. You know, there's a lot of problems that, you know, there's a lot of moving parts to it. Once you're out in the real world doing your job, that, you know, there's no textbook, the problems. You got to find the problems and trying to solve it in your way. Sometimes it requires, it requires critical thinking skills, exactly, to try to solve these issues. And, just that schools, including post-secondary colleges and things like that, you know, they're not stressing a lot of this. And I think, you know, critical thinking skills is, like, if you have that, you can, you know, I strongly believe that you can do, like, pretty much anything if you can think critically. Unfortunately, schools aren't really doing a great job with that.
Right, because in the real world, it's not about A is the right answer, right? It's not as black and white as, yeah, right? So, and I think you, Danny, can attest to that. We know that in accounting, there are a lot of times it's a gray area. You know, things aren't going to be perfect as much as we want them to be. We want there to be a right answer and a wrong answer. But sometimes, and I think there would be many examples you could probably give us of a time where it wasn't so cut and dried, where it could have gone either way and really had to work through the details.
Hey, sorry to stop you, Chelsea, but you're kind of echoing right now.
Huh?
Oh, you're echoing.
You're kind of echoing.
Is it better now?
Yeah.
Oh.
A little.
I can kind of hear it back in my earphones a little bit.
Yeah, it's better now. Do we lose you?
No, I'm here.
Are you?
It's still echoing back to me when I speak.
Hold on a sec. How about now?
Testing. Yeah, I still got it.
And now?
Yep.
I should just... Anyway,
I carried on for a while.
What's that? Yeah. What's that?
If you guys want to carry it on for a while, hopefully it'll just go away.
Yeah, I think that's the should be the foundation of education, is the ability to critically think. And I think good educators understand that, you know, even in higher education, if you get a degree in one area, it should be, you know, you should have the critical thinking skills to be able to transfer, you know, not only utilize those for the profession that you're studying, but for many other professions. And I think a lot of, you know, for right or wrong, there is a certain focus on trade mentality, you know, study for a certain profession, you know, go through you know, courses and exams that are required to participate in that profession at the really at the cost of having a well-rounded education that fosters critical thinking. And, you know, I think that's, you know, I don't know if there's really any easy solution for that. And I think when you get to the broken educational system that people reference, that's really one of the root causes of the problems. You get in, you know, the traditional classroom environments, and these teachers are focused on training up students, you know, kind of in the banker's education theory, or banking education, where you fill them up with facts that are really specifically used to pass standardized tests. And that's not the way that education should be conducted, in my opinion.
And no, I totally agree with what you say. So am I having issues with the double voice thing?
No.
Okay, I'm hearing myself.
You both are hearing yourself?
I am.
Okay, hold on a second here.
Intermission.
Okay. How are you doing? How does it sound now?
Testing. Yeah, I still can hear myself.
Yeah, unfortunately, I don't know. We've had all kinds of audio problems tonight, so it's kind of a bummer. So do you guys have, we should probably wrap up here in a few minutes. Do you guys have any final thoughts before we wrap up the podcast?
No, the only thing I would like to add is, you know, just going back to critical thinking skills, really, you really don't need, like, I'm a CPA right now, but I'm sure there's a lot of people out there, let's just face the facts, you know, who are non-CPAs who would still be better qualified doing the job, you know, what I'm doing. And, you know, a lot of it is, you know, education, and with our current educational system, it's, you know, you got to take all these classes and you need to get all these credits to become a CPA. You know, I think that's BS. I think that's crap. Just because I took these classes should not disqualify from someone else who wants to get like a CPA. But, you know, that's how the system is. It's rigged. I can see benefits of doing that because it does protect the profession, so not everyone can be a CPA. I don't know where I'm going at with this, but that's my final thoughts.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, I think that, you know, the model we're using was built out of, you know, the industrial era, where we had, you know, big manufacturing companies, and that's how we look at our education, where we stick students in and they come out as finished products later. Mm-hmm. You know, we stick them in as raw material, and then later they become finished goods. And we're realizing that's not effective and it's not helping anyone. And now that we're moving into the technological age, we have to come up with creative solutions that are going to benefit the children now and in the future. And whether that's with, you know, providing a hybrid class with online resources and a mixture of that and lecture, or, you know, focusing more on the critical thinking skills or assessing how we measure success, we don't have the answers, but we know that what we're doing now isn't working. Mm-hmm. And so it's up to us to really think about how we can improve upon what we're doing to get that desired outcome.
Yeah, and my final thought is there's a profound shift going on in within the educational area, and you know, I think in certain professional fields, there's I can't see if you're talking about lawyers or accountants or you know professional areas, there's always going to be a desire for certification and you know proof of qualification. To those fields, but in many other areas, there isn't that need. And with the continued augmentation of formal classroom training combined with peer collaborative training, you'll just see. I think some of the and I even see this happening more and more. I think some of those areas where you have gaps in critical thinking, just because of the abundance of information that's available to people. If there's a desire to learn, really, we don't. I don't think there's ever been a better time if you're really interested in getting a good education. You have access to so many resources. You know, maybe you don't have access to the best teachers in the world, but you have access to online communities that can augment whatever education you're looking to have. You have areas like. You know, like what Danny was referencing, Coursera, edX, Khan Academy, you know, for homeschooling, you have Ron Paul curriculum, which is, you know, a libertarian based curriculum, focusing on, you know, creating entrepreneurs and, engineers, scientists, that's very focused in the critical thinking aspect. So, you know, while in, you know, public schools, there are challenges. I think they're kind of like what you're seeing in other areas. There are such good tools and technologies that are available that they're going to, I think you're going to see a lot of transformation, in the classroom environments by providing access to great teachers, who may have not been accessible before. And as kind of a nice benefit to these people, they'll probably end up earning more money. They'll be able to monetize their teaching. People will pay them, donate to them. You know, they'll be able to increase their financial resources. So there, you know, there are a lot of challenges in classroom environments, but I think you know, through open source education and access to better teachers and methods, that you know. Going to have it's a good situation for a lot of students. So with that, if you guys don't have anything else, I will go ahead and wrap up. This has been Liberty Southwest podcast number 44. Everyone have a good night.
Good night.
Adios, mofo.
Later.